KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Whenever I'm asked who I would number among the most stylish and urbane people in the movie industry, I always say John Waters and people laugh. And I don't know why, because he's certainly a stylized individual who has a particular perspective about life and drama and comedy. I've always thought of him as being that rare person who has a sense of irony about snobbery. My guest, of course, is the writer-director and novelist John Waters, although I thought his book Carsick was kind of a short story collection, but his novel is the book Liar Mouth, A Feel Bad Romance. John, welcome back. It's so good to talk to you.
Thank you. Good to hear your voice again, Elvis.
One of the things that I love so much about this book is that it's about this thing that runs so often through your movies, the way people prepare and stage themselves to go outside.
Well, that's the difference between writing a screenplay and a novel. With a screenplay, you have to show it or they have to say it. But in a novel, you can go into sentence after sentence about how they feel when they say it or why they're saying it or how they're saying it, their tone of voice, everything. So it makes it much more intimate and at the same time, not harder, just a different way. To me, writing a novel and writing my next screenplay is exactly the same in hardness or easiness. You just have to go in there and do it every day. But you are right. I had written fiction. They were short stories in Carsick, except I was in them. And when you're in them, it makes it much easier because there's always the little bit of truth if somebody knows who you are in the first place. In Liar Mouth, you're meeting a whole new group of disreputable people all at once.
Yeah, it's the world's most distinctive screwball comedy, I think. There's a constant series of entrances going in that remind me of your movies, too. People constantly almost slamming doors coming in and out in this book the way they do in your movies.
Well, in this book, they're not only slamming doors, they're bouncing in because there's a whole pack of and a subplot about a cult of people that are beyond trampoline fanatics that must move at all times. And, you know, it's not that far-fetched. If you Google bouncing, it is a movement. I have, of course, exaggerated it where they become a minority that people are prejudiced against and people shout, don't bounce to them, you know. So it's really trying to take a new minority, actually, and give everybody their rights. But is there ever a limit? Is there ever a group of any kind of fanatics where their rights become comic?
I'm going to put you in a position to ask you to explain for our audience what the book is about.
It's about Marcia Sprinkle, who is a suitcase thief, and her employee named Daryl, his salary is that he gets to have sex with her once a year. But as she says, she's no man's used-up calendar. So right in the beginning, a really hideous scene happens that people think...
Which one?
Well, in the airport, when the little child punches Daryl in his erotic area. And this happens so early in the book. You think, this is in the first chapter? What could happen later? And I think I do keep it, the surprise limit going. So the narrative is pretty crazy in this. So many things happen to these people in 4 days that it's almost impossible to imagine, except that was my job to imagine it. So it's about a woman who is trying to rob her daughter, whose husband is also the head of a different kind of sexual minority, and they're all trying to stop and kill each other. It is a road movie in a book, and at the same time, it's a character study of many generations of dysfunction and how it's playing out today.
But I think one of the things that the book is about, too, that I associate you with, but we really get to see it played out here, is about obsession. And every character we meet has a kind of almost feverish obsession with something.
Yes, and I said that in one of my earliest books, that life is nothing if you're not obsessed. But obsession can take over and make your life unbearable, which maybe is almost happening to the trampolinists here, because they eventually get supernatural powers from all this movement. And then does that have a burden? Are there side effects of having miraculous powers? Do you get headaches? Is it easier to go back to normal living? So I'm trying to imagine the behavior of extremists of all different kinds and how they feel about normal things in their life.
But also the book is so much about really kind of extreme sort of sensation. I mean, that whole section with Daryl goes from him being punched to then being tased. And
and then his private part becomes gay when he's straight. And that does not mean bisexual. That means below the equator and above the equator are conflicting sexual desires. And that causes for a great internal battle. And a switch in politics, sexual politics, too, below the waist and above the waist.
Well, it's funny you say internal battle, because these characters all have internal battles. And we get to know Marcia so well in such a short period of time, and she's fighting with herself. And this idea of presenting yourself as one thing when you really inside you're something else and fighting your true nature or dealing with true nature is a through line that runs through a lot of your work as well.
Yes, but then she meets her own match. And that's what everybody does. Isn't that the scariest love affair you ever have? When you meet your match and the battle for power takes place. And my friend Pat Moran once said a long time ago, one person always loves the other more. Never let that person know which one you are. And that is a really scary thought, but very true. And I think that's what happens to Marcia. Marcia hates instinct. She hates sex. She hates defecation. She hates everything because it's human and she didn't get to think it up. That's why she doesn't like music. It competes with her. She doesn't like art because people are looking at other things beside her. But she feels no one has the right to ever look at her because she's better than anyone.
Well, see, that's the thing that fascinates me about this book is that inch per inch, it's packed with more narcissists than I think I've ever read outside of Dickens. It's kind of astonishing how self-absorbed these people all are.
Well, yeah, they are. And none of them have a sense of humor about themselves. That's why I think they're funny. Because the same way in my movie Cecil B. DeMille, people said, was he like you? No, I made fun of myself. They never did. You know, cults never make fun of themselves. And they are happy for a while in a cult. It is exciting to be in a cult until it gets bad and you're too far gone to realize it. So in this book, the trampoline is, in a way, they do become so obsessed with body movement that it brings them bliss, but so many more problems. And society turns against them for that. But at the same time, Marcia, she hates that she had a daughter. She hates that her mother had her. She hates being alive, but she is still imperious for reasons that only she knows.
It's the treatment. I'm talking to filmmaker and now novelist John Waters, whose first novel is Liar Mouth, a Feel-Bad Romance. I like the way you juxtapose Marcia and her daughter. Her daughter is basically entirely about physical sensation and looking for ways to sort of make that sensation even more powerful. And Marcia is completely fleeing from it.
Well, Marcia just thinks that they're a bunch of idiots. Stop jumping, you know, you fool. When they say that they are a protest movement, she says protest movements start with a march, not bouncing up and down. Stay on the ground then if you want to do it. So Marcia kind of does give them practical advice, but she's humiliated by them. So she likes to rob them because to her, lying and thievery and dishonesty makes her feel prettier. It makes her feel powerful, and she loves the anarchy she gets from lying. She practiced lies. It's like going to the gym for her. And she tells lies for no reason. She'll just take a suitcase in an airport and put it on the wrong carousel just to screw up that person's life for no possible reason.
As you were talking about this, and one of the things I think is so often in the movies, there is an innocent who kind of can see the entire world of craziness going on around them. And that character isn't really in this book, which really makes it seem that much more jet propelled.
Maybe the character in the book is me. the person who wrote it. Isn't that the person you just described?
I think so. But I mean, I always feel there's somebody who, like you, can see the best in everything, was kind of an optimist or wants to see the best in everything. And these people are so, again, such megalomaniacs. There's such a strain of solipsism that runs through all these people that can't see past their own noses.
But that is what I am, that person, because I'm trying to make you root for these people that are almost impossible to root for in real life. So to me, I've always made the heroine or the heroes of my movies be the villains in other people's things, but this time they would even be villains in my world. But at the same time, I'm marveling at their behavior and trying to understand it and really saying, if you can understand and root for these people, then you're a better person than you were when you started to read the book.
Well, you've got to know part of the way to make people root for your characters is to make them laugh.
Yeah, that's the only way you ever change anybody's opinion. Laughter is political. You want to argue with somebody, make them laugh. That's the only way you can disarm them for a second so they'll listen. The worst way is to get up and preach and make them feel stupid and everything. The way you win is to make them feel smart and sneak in and then change their opinion.
Again, I'm thinking about these characters who are almost like a Candide type character, even, you know, Pecker or Tracy and Hairspray, or so many times these characters at Divine Plate, they really can see, they see the world through these kind of rose-colored glasses. And I just wondered if you thought by removing that character from the book that the audience, in effect, becomes that person.
Maybe, but I think that Marcia Sprinkle could hang around with Serial Mom. I think she could hang around with Dawn Davenport. I think she could hang around with many of the other women I've written, and they could have a nice book club together, maybe. Or she would respect them. She would, at the same way, she does like one character in the book, the horrible bus driver that makes her be in a crash because he's so hateful to everybody that there is a grudging respect she gives to him.
No, I mean, she could be Serial Mom, or she could be Velma from Hairspray. I mean, so many of these characters that have been sort of the villains are here, her, but we get a chance to sort of go inside and see where all that insecurity comes from, that kind of terror. So she wants everybody else to feel that terror before she does. So it's that way she at least has control.
But Marcia does. You find out what happened to her when she was young, and her trauma is worth lower than any Jerry Springer show, but at the same, I said it's really worse, more than any sex therapist needs to hear, really, what happened to her. But at the same time, it's so ludicrous, but possible. Everything in this book is almost possible.
Everything in this book feels like it's a half a centimeter away from being terribly plausible.
I know. That's what I want to do, that maybe this is next. What we think, just when you think you've seen everything, then this comes. Pet plastic surgery, which the grandmother does, I think they already do that. And it is true that you can have fake testicles put on your dog after you've had them dog fixed so people don't think you've done it.
But you take a while to let us know what's going on with Marcia and why she is the way she is. So, I mean, it's not like you offer us an explanation of who she is, even in the first third of the book. We have to live with her and go on this crazy ride in these three intersecting worlds for a long time.
Yes, to find out when she meets her match and to find out what can change her is that she has met her match. And he has gone through a very different trauma, but one that is related in the same way to some things that happened to her. So together they become a power team when they finally meet up. And then what they do causes even more anarchy than Marcia could have ever planned from just lying. She met someone that maybe has equal or more power than she does.
I mean, chewing the inside of my mouth, we're all trying not to give too much away because that last section of the book where I don't want to say everything comes together, but when these three different circuses all are under the same big top is really this kind of paroxysm of insanity.
But yeah, and I'm moving back to Provincetown where I go every summer this coming Sunday. I'm not sure how I will be received in the community.
Yeah, we should say the last section of the book happens at Provincetown, a place if you've never been, you will never want to go there again because it's kind of the apocalypse.
I think the celebration that happens at the end of Liarmouth might happen in Provincetown. We're not far away from it. We have Gay Pilots Week. We have Baby Duck Week. This is not that hard to imagine they could have it. Especially after the book, they could really get into it. I have all the celebrations, everything. All you need. The town council, the tourism board is pretty liberal.
Words that can only come from the mouth of our guest, novelist and filmmaker John Waters. His debut novel is Lawyermouth, A Feel Bad Romance. It's the treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us. My guest, who is not only a novelist and a filmmaker, but also even played a Franklin Pangborn-type character in the Mickey Mouse cartoon, is John Waters. His novel is Lawyermouth, A Feel Bad Romance. And one of the things we were talking about in the first half of the show, people's hunger for power in the things you create. There's always somebody who wants to be the center of the known world and will do almost anything to get there. In fact, I thought that line from your book, believe your own grandiosity and go wrong to make your career go right, just as I did.
Well, that's true. You do have to believe. People always say to me, did you ever think all this would happen in your life? Well, yes, or I wanted it to. I read Variety when I was 13. I wasn't some naive little kid in Lutherville. But at the same time, I was always inspired by people that were showmen. You know, I thought up ad campaigns. I thought up, I mean, even with Liarmouth, I can give you the trailer. Here it is. Liarmouth, Marcia Sprinkle, scammer, suitcase thief, children and dogs hate her. Her own family wants her dead. She's on the run with a big chip on her shoulder. They called her Liarmouth until one insane man made her tell the truth. See, I can't help it.
He just gave us the poster if American International made this movie in 1959.
I think
that hunger for power, and by the way, that line I quoted is from your book, Mr. Know-It-All, which you should also read. But I think that need to be the most powerful and to dictate and in fact be royalty is something that we see it so often in your work, too. Somebody who wants to be basically so often the queen of everything.
They do, but they want to be it in a universe that I try to bring you in that is not a universe that most people would want to even be a citizen in, much less the queen or king of. So I am setting up an alternative world, and I set rules, and I sense reality, even though it's crazy, but I stick to that. There is such a thing, a copy editor, basically, is what a continuity person does in a movie, where no matter what the rules are, it still has to make sense. You still have to, in that day, this could have happened. They'd steal an outfit. They have to have that on page 76. So I very much follow the rules that I set up for myself. But it's always to make fun of rules that I've had to live with since I left my parents' rules.
We really do feel this, just the book is kind of straining at the seams because there's so much incident and so many people and so many points of view. We know who these folks are immediately. And I just wonder how you sort of kept all those things separate, because there's a way this thing could have been an overwhelming experience for people. And you've got to have some kind of measure of pace so we can still sort of know where we are at all times.
Yeah, and I did keep lots of notes. Basically, I did 7 or 8 drafts of the book before I even turned it in. The first draft's the hardest, but rewriting is when it gets good. And each time it gets better and better. And you usually hate the first draft when you read it. I do, at least. And then you make it good. And the plot can happen on its own as you keep writing. And then you think, wow, this could work. And then you have to go back and rewrite other parts. But that's how it works out. And then eventually, once you're done, you put something back in, you know you're done. That you took something out in the very beginning and that maybe was right in the beginning. So I think the characters have a life of their own, even though you're every one of them in your head. You when you're writing a book, you dream about it. You wake up and you think, oh, that's a great plot point. And you write something down, and then you read it the next morning. It makes no sense at all. But you're still dreaming about it, which means that you are those people. Those people are in you.
There's this thing in Liarmouth that I like, that I really associate with the best of your films, so that what feels like just these random incidents are really building towards something. And when you get to the last section, you kind of go, oh, it seemed like a bunch of shaggy dog stories or shaggy fake dog testicle stories, but in fact, is leading us somewhere.
Yeah, that each little thing has a clue to it of the plot, but it's building the narrative is so many plots, you know, that are in there all building to this one thing. So each time I even said one character in that sentence, I tell you part of their story. Each sentence something happens in, which in a way is making fun of narrative because nothing can happen that fast. And plot is important. Plot is what makes a hit movie or a hit book. But maybe I purposely have so much plot that that becomes a parody, too.
I was wondering if that's what some of you were trying to do, because it has that kind of power that seems free associative, and you're waiting for the end to come. You go, oh, wait, we're not even a third of the way into it.
Well, the end does happen, and it definitely has a real end. And
oh, my gosh. Oh, yes.
And it has a surprise ending, I think, too. But at the same way, I think it's a consistent ending with every character in the book, how I've built them up, what their needs are, what their passions are, and what their insane hopes were. They're all happy in their own right. All the people in the book, except maybe Daryl, but he'll be happy if he can just once do what he wants to do. So I don't think anyone is unhappy in their insanity in this book. They're struggling, they're insane, they're angry, but they believe they're doing the right thing, which makes all zealots and people that are obsessed happy.
Well, see, that's the thing I find fascinating about it, too. And it's something that, again, I see so often in your work, and I wonder where this comes from, these gradations in narcissism. And Marcia is an angry narcissist.
Oh, my God, she's beyond that. Yeah, she hates anything that competes with her. And she really hates instinct. She hates the universe that she didn't get to think up. She hates that her body has functions that she didn't invent. She's angry at everything except herself.
I mean, there's a line that describes her early in the book that could have come out of Philip Roth. Silence is about her. Oh, my God.
And she also says she smells like nothing, which is the way she'd want it. She lives in abandoned McMansions because there's no taste there. It's not good taste or bad taste. It's nothing but her. And she needs empty rooms around her that can't compete with her, but she knows are there to enter and own if she feels like it.
Speaking of taste, my guest is probably the only novelist ever to include the line, a vintage multicolored knick-knick shirt in his book. The book is Liarmouth. My guest is novelist and filmmaker John Waters.
You know what a knick-knick shirt is, right?
I still own a few.
Do you? Do you wear them?
They're polyester. They're not going anywhere. Trust me. Those things will outlive all of us, those shirts. I bet you had a couple in your life, too.
I never wore a knick-knick shirt. Nope, never. Never. That's why I made a movie called Polyester. We made fun of that, really. I was in Reno, Nevada, doing my show. I felt like Shecky Green. And there was a couch in my suite that looked exactly like the couch in Polyester. It was the exact couch. And that couch got a laugh. It was the only couch I ever knew in a movie that just one sight of it by itself, like an Ed Wood, no, a Doris Wishman cutaway, made people laugh of just a couch that was so hideous. Well, I had the exact same couch. It made me feel almost awkward, but still nostalgic.
This point of view emerged for you in your work early on, and it still exists and really kind of is at its ne plus ultra in Liarmouth. That is, you define characters by their taste.
Well, I still do that in real life by their taste, certainly. I mean, what's on airplanes today now, how people dress is beyond, you know, have you ever seen those little cards that people hand people to say, stop talking? I've never had the nerve to hand somebody, a stranger, that. But I want one to say, nice outfit. Because I see people in dirty, filthy pajama bottom cutoffs and a t-shirt and flip-flops. Get dressed. I don't want your COVID legs rubbing up against mine. It is really outraging me. I feel like Serial John when I'm on airplanes today. We need the fashion police for real.
There are two or three major players in everything you've done who define themselves by their taste. And I just wonder what made you understand that that was a great way to bring a character to life, because it's an incredible motivating thing. And it's a rarity, I think, in American fiction.
Well, how everybody dresses and how they wear their hair or anything is the first way they advertise themselves. It's the first clue you have about people's personality. I remember when Martha Plimpton made a movie with me, she said, as long as I get the hair down, I have the character. As long as I know what their hair is. And I think that is the first way that you advertise yourself and announce yourself to the world. So it is your calling card.
But for me, that relationship to taste often masks an astonishing amount of self-delusion, too. I mean, we see it certainly in Marcia. We see it in Poppy as well, and Adora, I guess, too. But you can have somebody who really is motivated by taste who has a complete lack of self-awareness. That kind of contradiction is a fascinating dynamic to set into motion for a character.
Well, are they lacking in self-awareness? Maybe they are aware of themselves, just other people don't understand why they think that way. I think every one of the characters believes in what they're doing completely. They're not doubting themselves.
Yes. No, I wasn't trying to say that they have a moment of doubt, because you can't be a narcissist and be doubtful, but they are so motivated by taste, and they think that somehow that taste makes them somebody beyond reckoning with.
Yes, that makes them superior. That Marcia feels that no one even should ever make eye contact with her or anything. And Poppy does not understand why anybody would be horizontal, not vertical. She has to be going up and down the whole way. Adora does not understand why anybody would let their pet look not at their best or improve on things that were not even anything the matter with them in the first place. I mean, even herself, she gets a belly button operation the wrong way because she finds the any belly button so repulsive of being nature's trash can. But she goes through this obsession about her belly button until she finally gets it poked out the other way, which is an operation you can get. And then she feels confident. People are touchy about their own bodies.
Or in Marcia's case, not touchy. But I guess what I was asking you
too is that... Well, she looks good, though. Marcia knows that she can use her body, as she says, to entrap people. But she does not like her bodily functions. Not that she doesn't... Her body is fine.
Oh, no, but she doesn't like to be touched. She really doesn't like to be touched.
No, she does not like to be touched in any way. Until she meets the person that steals from her, that puts one over on her.
I'm working so hard trying not to give too much away here because there are worlds within worlds within worlds here. But what you would do in the book with so many people, it's this way that it feels like it's this kind of apotheosis of so many things you've done up until now. It's basically people, an entire book with people who want to remake the world in their image.
Yep. And two are successful.
Given how much more this world has become about this kind of dangerous cultism and these narcissists who are looking for a parent figure and remaking or trying to make everything like the way they want it to be and refusing to listen to anybody else. I mean, it really is consonant with the times.
Well, I'm trying to make fun of all that, but at the same time, embrace it. The rules that I have to live by today. I used to fear one side. Now I don't fear the other, but if it's going to come from one direction, it's confusing. I lived in a world when I was young where people had sex with somebody different every night, and it was normal in my world. And today, you need 5 lawyers to ask somebody for a date. So I have lived in the most opposing different moral times, and both were insane. And so I love to live in insane worlds, but especially sometimes as a voyeur rather than a complete person that believes. I believe in myself, too. I have made what I wanted to do happen. But I also have a sense of humor about myself, I hope.
Well, it's what I said in the opening. It's one of the things I think I love about you the most is that you have a sense of irony about snobbery. And snobs generally tend to not have that kind of self-awareness.
But I am a snob.
That's my point. Snobs usually don't have that kind of self-awareness or awareness enough to be ironic about their snobbery or snobs in general. But you are unique in that respect, I think.
Well, I when I say I'm a snob, I say that I'm just a snob because I'm so impressed by people that believe in themselves, even if they're completely crazy. So I like people that are smart, even if they're nuts. But I also like some dumb people that are really smart and that don't even realize it. So I like all kinds of people except people that have no opinions about anything.
Well, I'll take that as a compliment. We're out of time. My guest is John Waters. His first novel, I'll say that, is the book Liar Mouth, A Feel-Bad Romance. John, it's always great to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Elvis, for having me on.
That was someone for whom taste is paramount. Filmmaker, actor, and now novelist John Waters on his first novel, Liar Mouth, A Feel-Bad Romance. I hope you can stay with us for the next segment with Zach Mirabak, founder of ZMF Headphones. If you can't, you can listen to that interview, any of several with our old friend John Waters, and other previous episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com/thetreatment. Or, as they say, wherever you get your podcasts. You can get more of The Treatment if you stay with us.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on the Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on the Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's the treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. And when I came across a pair of headphones called the Auteur, I thought there had to be something interesting and unique, just the name alone. So I did a little research into the brand, ZMF, and I'm here with the founder, Zach Mirbach. You can hear the influence of theater on these. And Zach, your background is, you have a master's in film directing, right?
Yeah, I mean, my dream was to be a film director from undergraduate school through graduate school. And then I slowly, through going to grad school, got into audio and listening to headphones and, you know, ended up making these wood headphones for a living instead of becoming a film director. Although I think there's a lot of crossover in there.
Well, talk about that. What do you think the crossover is?
You know, to make a great film, like making a good headphone, there's just, you know, there's what ends up on screen. And then there's all the pre-production, so to speak, that goes into both. And so, you know, what you see on screen is the culmination of, you know, all those hours and pain spent trying to figure out, in a film's case, a storyline, or, you know, with a headphone, how it's going to sound and be received by an audience.
It's so interesting because I just sort of thought about putting these things on and just to sort of the kind of cathedral audio space of the headphones. It's like being in an old school movie theater. And the first thing I started doing was pulling up stuff like, you know, my some old Ralph Towner albums and the guitarist John Williams, because I just felt like the optimum kind of stuff to listen to through these headphones, but also stuff done with a Hammond B3. So I was digging up some old Jimmy Smith albums and the open air quality that you get from these. I mean, they really are kind of cathedral-like, aren't they? There's an architecture to the construction, isn't there?
Yeah, and I mean, you talk about old movie theaters and, you know, listen to Hammond B3 and stuff, and that's always kind of the intent with a headphone, is whoever's listening to it so that they can call back from their auditory memory, like, hey, what is some experience I've had that these headphones help me, you know, really get back to? How can I get that realistic experience again? And I mean, yeah, it's a weird thing because you're putting this thing on your face, you know, where you're trying to get people to, you know, have that experience. And I guess that's why headphones are so personal, is because, you know, it's all about that memory and trying to tap into that.
You were just talking about sort of the pre-production, which is to say the construction, the design, all the kinds of things that go into making a movie that are details that you either catch or don't catch as a viewer, or in this case, as a listener. And I do feel that there's, in the audio stage, just kind of an open air quality. And I should say, too, they're made of wood. And that's why I thought, well, because the Hammond isn't with the organ with the old Leslie speakers, which right. are all made of wood. And I just thought about finding, you know, acoustic guitar, because that felt like something that would be simpatico with the design of the headphones themselves.
As you mentioned, I went to film school, and so I'm not an acoustical engineer, although I've talked to many of them. And a lot of times at headphone shows, I'll get to my booth and some guy I don't know will come up and be like, what's your training? And I'll be like, I went to film school. And he'll be like, so you don't know anything about audio? And I'm like, well, I do my best. but I used to build acoustic guitars, and a lot of my ideas come from those kind of wooden instrument. I didn't do it professionally. I did it as a hobby, but like the atrium idea, having that, you know, our patent pending design back there that gets that space, comes from kind of acoustic guitar soundboards and how they have to be radiused a little bit to have, you know, how they sound. And, you know, every acoustic guitar maker has different radiuses and stuff, but that's kind of part of the idea. So a lot of this stuff I'm doing in audio, it does not come from traditional, you know, acoustical backgrounds like that. And that's part of what differentiates our headphones in a way.
Anything that somebody does that they have I think, an affinity for and do by hand and craft like that. You're trying to create experience that relates to something that makes sense to you. And I don't know why, but just putting these things on, I immediately felt like I wanted to hear guitar in them, just the open air and the way they've been sort of planed and carved. There's something about space in there. For me, equating that kind of space to the space and the really high ceilings of all movie theaters.
Yeah, and I think there's something cool about that space. And most of the places we experience old movies or a concert or something, and that's part of why we called that headphone that we sent you the atrium, is because, you know, there's this weird correlation. I think the best correlation with film is that, you know, now we're in an era where we shoot things digitally mostly. And, you know, when I went to film school 10, 15 years ago, it was all about coming out of actual 16 millimeter, 35 millimeter film. And now I know a lot of directors and editors and everything add that grain and, you know, the imperfections back into it. And the same thing with audio. It's like, how do you get a little bit of that imperfection that is, you know, what is human to us, you know, back in there to make us feel those spaces? Because if it's too perfect, if it's too damped, and anyone who's ever been in an anechoic room knows that when you're in there, you know, you can hear your heartbeat, and that's just a strange feeling. So you want to get out of that a little bit.
By the way, it's a treat. My guess is the founder of ZMF Headphones, Zach Mirbach, we're talking about his incredible work and his background as a film person. And I just want to ask you about the kind of movies you saw growing up and the kinds of theaters you saw them in, because that sound, I mean, if you go from like an old school movie theater to, you know, like a multiplex box, which is a very different kind of design, all these kind of places that almost kind of come with a kind of an audio fatigue as compared to old movie theaters. I just wonder what the films you saw, and if there's so any kind of oral experiences that really stuck with you, like as a kid growing up watching movies.
I grew up in Lyme, New Hampshire, which is like the town over from Hanover where Dartmouth College is. And so there are really two movie theaters in the whole town, and those two were both on the Dartmouth campus, and one is, I think it's still there, called the Nugget, like a nugget. It was a small theater with not much space. And then the other one is the Spalding Auditorium at Dartmouth College, which is huge. I saw Jurassic Park in the Spalding Auditorium, and I will remember that experience forever just because it was the first time I saw a movie in a giant space. And you know, having all the audience around and hearing the echo and the reverb really stuck with me. And I think that's something that's one of the reasons I choose wood to work with for headphones, is because if you choose a lighter weight wood in a headphone, much like a guitar or, you know, any other instrument, it has like a little more lasting decay to it, like almost ambience or reverb. And that just has always felt or sounded more natural to me.
Yeah, there's a great kind of reverb or sustain, if you want to call it that, that I hear in the speakers, and it just really makes me think, again, about film and about the way the audio experience is designed at its best to be something that complements a film, because when it sticks out in a way, we were just talking before we got started about things that are too bright, it's that kind of thing that it's, when it calls attention to itself, it feels like it's kind of exhibitionistic and can really sort of like become tiring after a while. And what's so great about the atrium is they really complement the experience rather than overwhelm.
Especially since the pandemic started. I mean, there's so many new people to the audiophile hobby, you know, because there's just so much more of it, all the personal things. And so everybody's thinking about, you know, how to experience things. And I know, you know, over at Meta or Facebook, they're all pitching the whole metaverse thing now. And a lot of more people I know have, you know, those Oculus. So, I mean, it's just something I've started to think more about every time we make a headphone, is how's this going to fit in with how everything's, you know, changed.
Yeah, are you thinking about that now? Because you're right. I mean, there's so much VR and AR and these devices that are meant to sort of really expand the home entertainment experience. Is that something you think about as you're designing these headphones, how your work might go with those kinds of things?
I like gaming, so to speak, but I've never been a gamer. Like, I don't go to competitions and stuff like that. But people would always email and be like, hey, how do the footsteps sound? Or can I hear, you know, the enemy from behind the corridor, from 70 feet away. And so the sense of space and all these kind of things has gotten more and more important as people use headphones more and more for stuff that's not just listening to music. And so, I mean, that was the challenge with the Atrium, was making sure it sounded good with music and worked for all those other platforms. And that's why that sense of space becomes important in that, because differentiating, you know, if you're playing a massive online multiplayer game, if some guy's behind you, you want to be able to figure that out.
But I as you're talking about that, yeah, and the way the gaming audio experience has been designed, again, this is all movies. It takes us back to Jurassic Park and the audio imaging in the theater, and the way you want to create a kind of sense of space and movement. And all these things have to come into play too when you're designing headphones, don't they?
Yeah, and I mean, even like the THX stuff that I think Lucasfilm started is like pretty prominent, you know, branding and the audiophile stuff now. So there's a lot of crossover there between those experiences and how they work. And, you know, one of my favorite movies is Drive, the film with Ryan Gosling. And I just love that movie. And when I was teaching film, I taught it all the time, the color theory and all that stuff. But since the pandemic started, the sound designer for that film emailed me just because he was interested in getting into headphones because, you know, the pandemic kind of gave him the time to do that. And so it's just been interesting talking about the cross reference of stuff like that. It's been really neat to, you know, meet people who going both ways with my background in film.
Well, how do you end up finding out about the company?
I mean, and the way most audiophiles, you know, hear about our stuff is through like online forum. I mean, there's such that's one of the weird things about the headphone community is the advertisement for it kind of has done itself. I haven't really spent that much money trying to promote ZMF since I started, because there's these communities that are just really, really, and just like, you know, film or anything else, just they're so into the hobby of audio. And a lot, I mean, part of it too, it's just as much about the gear as it is about the music. And, you know, that's a fascinating part of it, is that there get to be points where you're really not talking about music at all anymore. You're talking about, you know, how it's reproduced, which is a whole nother conversation for sure.
Tell me about some of the films that you were teaching, because I guess you were teaching and trying to get the company going at the same time. So what were some of the films that you were passionate enough about, like Drive, that you wanted to have your students understand how much these films meant to you and how they were communicating the potential of the medium?
Yeah, so I was teaching as an adjunct faculty member at Columbia College Chicago, which is the same school where I got my master's degree from, for, I don't know, I guess 4 or 5 years, until I stopped doing that to run ZMF full time. And it mostly, I taught a production one or production two class to freshmen and sophomores. And so a lot of it was just trying to, you know, get the hero's journey down and stuff like that. And I think the first thing I always showed to students was the Chris Farley Van Down by the River skit from Saturday Night Live, which I know is not a film, but it very easily is funny to watch. And, you know, you can teach the dramatic question and, you know, film from using that, of just like, what's going to happen at the end? Is this guy going to stay or is he going to leave? You know? And so those kind of elements are what I would start to get into. And then, you know, later on, we'd be able to get into stuff like Drive and color theory and stuff like that.
And that's interesting to me, because I guess what you're doing in the class, and I think what, you know, what the ZMF headphones do too, is you're basically using the medium to talk about how it can change somebody's, you know, psychological state in ways that they wouldn't notice until it was pointed out to them. And in building the headphones and constructing really the audio stage you want presented, you're trying to do the same thing to get people to be moved by this in ways that they might not want to articulate.
There's so many, like, so much music, as you know, that means so much to people. And it's, I mean, definitely the best experience when either me or my wife also runs the company with me. And we get emails and people will be like, oh, I got your headphones and I listened to this song and it just means so much to me that I can hear it in this way. It makes me think of this. And so it's kind of like what we were going through earlier, is like finding that telescope to the auditory memory that makes people have, you know, emotional experiences. In film, with the color theory stuff, a lot of times you want to do it without making someone conscious that it's happening. And that's, you know, the tough part about film.
It's funny as you're talking about that, just sort of thinking about how people like Stevie Wonder, who has synesthesia, where, you know, the audio experience to them comes across as a series of colors. And I feel like so often people are trying to describe stuff like the headphones, they're almost trying to do the same kind of thing, which is to describe what that sound does to them and the way that color changes the way we feel or think about something.
That's definitely really true. You can have all those different feelings based on all the things that surround it, which I guess for a headphone is kind of how it might feel on your head or what you're plugging it into. And, you know, there's always this debate, what's placebo and what's not, and the audio, you know, do cables really change the sound and stuff? So, and that's the thing. It's like, if you believe it is changing it, then that's enough. That's all, you know, who am I to tell you it does or doesn't?
Well, you actually have, you know, scientific information that I guess or prove a point or not prove a point. Finally, headphones are really personal for people, especially in a period where like the past couple of years of the pandemic, where people are really asking themselves questions about the way they interface with entertainment. It's become to mean so much more to them. I would think that this has been a really interesting time for your company because it's compelled people to ask questions about the way they absorb entertainment that they hadn't asked themselves before.
Our audience has grown since the pandemic started. You know, now it's shrinking back down a little bit with the pandemic kind of flatlining and possible recession and all that stuff. But anyone from people who've been an audiophile for 40, 50 years to people who, you know, want to buy a ZMF as their first audiophile headphone. And, you know, and that's kind of a lot of the joy of it is talking to people and figuring out where our headphones might fit into their lives. Because, I mean, that's the thing about it. It's a business at the end of the day, and you don't want to, we are selling a product, and you don't want to sell something to someone, especially when your face is on the company and people can look you up online and see you that they're not going to enjoy. So a lot of it's solving that mystery of like, hey, will they actually like one of our headphones?
It's the treatment. My guest is Zach Mirbach, whose company is ZMF Headphones. And let me ask you this. As you started to get the company going, I wonder if it sort of changed the way you listen to movies. I mean, because as you're building this product and asking yourself what qualities you want to have people experience, because in effect, you're asking people to listen to the world the way you hear it with something like this. I just wonder if you started to think different about movies. If you're hearing stuff like Dolby Atmos or the kind of sound separation and enhancement technologies that are being used now in movies, if you started to change the way you experience that stuff and listen to it, and because you're making decisions about, again, what you want people to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's obviously not a single moment where I was like, oh, I need to experience film in a different way. But I think, you know, going to film school and getting to know a lot of sound designers, sound engineers, both on set and, you know, in the recording and mixing rooms, that you start to realize, oh, like, if I want to get whatever the sound engineer's intent was, I need, you know, to have surround speakers, or I need to have a subwoofer, or I need to have this. And and that's the kind of danger in a way, is that you get thinking about how it was intended to be experienced or not, and then trying to build a system around that. And then the more you do that, the more it gets away from maybe the storyline intent of just watching a film. I mean, it's all cool stuff both ways, but I've definitely have gone down the route of like, I have a projector in our house now that's, you know, on a big screen and, you know, 5.1 or 7.1 system and all that stuff. And I want to see what the intent was from the filmmaker when I watch them. And that has definitely changed somewhat. And I think a lot of people, and more people have home theaters now than ever, I think. I mean, I don't know what the movie theater sales aren't, but I know they probably aren't what they used to be.
Well, I mean, I think they're bouncing back up now just because people are less reticent and more eager to be out and go see movies and see them with an audience. And part of that, too, though, as you know, you just talked about that big theater where you saw Jurassic Park, is being in there and being surrounded by other bodies and what that mass of people does to the audio experience.
Yeah, and I mean, that's something where, you know, it's kind of you know, I've been pretty COVID conscious during the last couple of years because I don't want to be absent from, you know, helping our employees and our business and everything. But, you know, you definitely miss being around other people. And, you know, it's like going to a baseball game or anything. When a guy, you know, hits a home run, it's not the same hearing it on any pair of speakers as it is when there's 35,000 people standing up to watch a ball go over a fence. Yeah, you can't, there's some things you just can't replicate.
It's interesting. I guess I want to go back, Zach, to the word auteur. And you have to be very specific about the way you chose that, because what you're creating in audio terms is an auteur's experience. I mean, in a lot of ways that filmmakers really can't, you're counting on your own design, your own handmade, hard-wrought knowledge of what audio tonality is, what it does to people, to create an experience for someone. You get to be, in fact, an auteur in a way that very few filmmakers do.
In film school, we talked about how kind of the, you know, especially in mainstream, the modern auteur is kind of becoming, well, not completely less and less, but there's not as many as there might have been in the 50s, 60s, 70s, people with singular voices that are allowed to really carry that through. And I guess that's correlated to how, you know, I've been able to build headphones. There was a headphone show we went to where a bunch of the Sony engineers were there, and they had made a headphone that was kind of, you know, similar price range as ours. And one after one, the engineers came over and talked to me. It had to be five or six guys were at this show, and they all came over and looked at my headphone and then said, oh, I like this or I like that. And I talk about their headphones. But what it made me realize is that with a lot of things nowadays, because there's more people and more means and all that stuff, like this Sony headphone, this headphone was crafted, I found out, by like 20 or 30 people. And, you know, when you have so many people working on a film or a headphone or anything, you get all those voices. And a lot of times a singular idea doesn't always come through because of that. And for better or worse with ZMF, you know, the auteur was my kind of first headphone where I felt really good about what we were releasing. And so I named it that because I knew this was kind of a singular idea that I was putting out, you know, sonically. And something that I've realized now is pretty unique in anything in life is being able to create something from start to finish with a very singular vision.
At the beginning, when you were first getting started, I mean, you do have a team now because you're producing a lot more of these pieces, and thank goodness the demand is there. But when the very beginning, it was just kind of you and a soldering iron, wasn't it?
Yeah, I always tell this story to people when they're like, how did you get started? And I was just trying to modify a Fostex T50RP headphone at our kitchen table. And my wife walked in after work and was like, hey, we're going to eat in a little bit. Is this like a new thing or is this like a new hobby? How long do you think this is going to? And I was just like, I don't know. You know, then I ended up taking out, you know, because I had terrible credit because of film school at the time, taking out a credit card under her name with $15,000 on it to fund the rest of making wood headphones, which thank God, you know, worked out because I don't know if I ever would have lived that down. But, you know, it went from being, you know, me sitting at that kitchen table, yeah, to having a workshop, and we have 12 employees now. So it's been a crazy journey that way.
Well, I can't thank you enough for doing this and believing my name is actually Elvis Mitchell. My guest is Zach Mirbach. His product is ZMF headphones. They're terrific pieces of work. I mean, what an artist is supposed to do is bring a point of view to an idiom. And I think that's what you do with the headphones.
Thanks for having me, Elvis.
That was Zach Mirbach, filmmaker turned headphone designer. He's the founder of ZMF Headphones. And sound is the key for the treat this week. KCRW's spinner of oral landscapes, Anthony Valadez, is next. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Next, in our inadvertent series with radio stars more famous than me, KCRW franchise player Anthony Valadez. Yes, he's co-host of Say It With Me, Morning Becomes Eclectic. On The Treat this week, how he learned to like the places life is showing you.
Hey, it's Anthony Valadez, and this is The Treat.
Do you know what you
Diana Ross's Mahogany, the theme from Mahogany. I'll never forget, my mother denied me the right to go see the Lakers when they won their championship during their dynasty, the Showtime Lakers, and I was so sad. And on the radio, we were on the corner of Sepulveda and Lanark in the Valley, about to make a left, and that song came on, and I felt like Diana Ross was singing to me, saying, "Do you know where you're going to?" And I was about seven. And never in my life have I been asked, do I know where I'm going to? Do I like the things that life's showing me? What happens when you close one door? And I just remember being so moved emotionally. Once we were standing still
in time. When you're a young kid, you don't understand that the universe is throwing things at you. And at that moment, I did, and I caught it like an outfielder for the Dodgers. It was like my gloves were out and I caught that foul ball at Dodger Stadium. That's exactly what it feels like. My mother and father weren't really always there. And to hear somebody actually say, you know, ask these questions, are you okay? Was really moving. And I don't think there was a lot of that in a lot of households where I grew up. You know, are you okay? Kind of like the way we embrace mental health today wasn't really a thing back then. But to hear somebody say, are you okay? You know, asking me these questions, do you like where you're at? Do you like where you're going? Was just like, wow, this is really moving. I mean, culturally, I think being biracial, you know, you're always pivoting between the duality. You know what I'm saying? I think duality has a lot to do with that. Like, I remember growing up listening to like Jodeci with all my friends, but they would come knock on my door to go to school. But I was watching Morrissey live from Dallas, and I had to turn that off the VCR real quick. Because what would they think if I'm, you know, we love like Naughty by Nature and Jodeci and all this stuff. And like, I couldn't let them know that I love Morrissey. So the same thing with like Diana Ross. I mean, that's just... creatively, that just moves me. And I think that's what I always aspire to, is just to be moved and to move others. Anytime I create, I want that string section from the theme from Mahogany by Diana Ross, because it was so moving. And even at the age of seven, I knew that anything I do in life, it has to match the intensity, the beauty of that string section, of those lyrics of Diana Ross. When I was four or five or seven, I didn't know. I knew where I was at, and I just thought that's the way it is, and that's the way it's going to be. But things have changed. Like, I didn't expect to live past 25, to be straight up. And now that I'm 44, I have to think about retirement. I have to think about the next door. And I think about the previous doors that I've closed and how each one was a stepping stone for me to get here and to kind of be in these situations where I get to share my story, you know? And it all starts from the corner of Sepulveda and Lanark, about to make a left turn, and being sad because I couldn't go to that Laker parade. We let so many dreams just slip through our hands. Why must we wait so long before we see? How sad the answers to those questions can be. Life is nothing without someone to share it with, which is also from the film Mahogany, as is the film's theme song, which was illuminated on The Treat this week by our very own Anthony Valadez. Thanks for sharing The Treatment with us. Rebecca Mooney edits and produces the program. It's mixed by Katie Gilchrist, helped this week by Laura Kandarajan and Anna Buzz. Or what you're hoping for with music from Ann Litt. Maybe one day she'll do The Treat. To better days, everyone. Laughing at the questions. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.